From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Illich family promised big development around Little Caesars Arena, secured $340 million in taxpayer funding to help build the arena, but 2 years later, the promises haven't been kept.
We saw the arena and the business school, and wow, doesn't that look great? And nobody was really paying attention to the fact that the rest of it was being turned into parking lots.
Fighting to lower Michigan's maternal and infant mortality rates.
What we see here is a lack of primary care. And so a lot of these women have some chronic conditions that just aren't taken care of, and then they get pregnant and they get very sick.
A promising first quarter for Ford and CEO Jim Hackett.
Success really is about continual, consistent execution.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There is a pretty blunt headline in today's Detroit News, and I quote, Illich's vision for downtown Detroit was a mirage. That's what Detroit News editorial page editor Nolan Finley has to say about the much ballyhooed promises from the Illich family for the District Detroit, the spinoff development that was to blossom around its Little Caesars Arena. Nolan Finley, in a nutshell, what did Chris Illich promise for the District Detroit?
Well, what they promised was an arena that would be a catalyst for redeveloping this area north of downtown, the Cass Corridor, between downtown and midtown. They promised five distinct neighborhoods, lots of apartments, lots of new housing, offices, entertainment areas, restaurants, commercial space. This was supposed to be a transformational project, more than just an arena, more than just a sports facility. What they promised was something, a project more ambitious than we've ever seen before in this city. And that's why people got so excited. $2 billion in new investment.
We're talking about a big area, right? 50 blighted blocks around LCA.
50 blocks, yes. Mm-hmm. And the city helped them acquire the land. The city helped them get demolition permits to tear down the existing buildings, some of which were occupied, some of which were historic buildings. So the city helped them assemble this land, gather this land for what was supposed to be a transformational project.
And they and all the promises helped the Illiches win, we have to remind everybody, a $340 million boost in taxpayer money to help build the LCA. So for listeners who have not seen the surrounding area, Nolan, describe what's there nearly 2 years after the ribbon cutting at LCA.
Gravel parking lots. 27 gravel parking lots. They did build the Wayne State Business School, named after the patriarch, Mike Illich, and they did build the arena. But behind it, in the area that the district neighborhood was supposed to be, the District Detroit, by this time we were supposed to have already seen 700 new apartments built back there, and instead we've got nothing. Parking lots, graveled parking lots, 27 of them. The worst thing you could do to a city. It sucks the energy out of a city. It makes a city look empty. If you're going to build parking, you should build parking decks with ground floor retail, ground floor space. Nobody anywhere is building surface parking lots in downtown areas anymore. I compare it to Milwaukee, which opened its FiServ Forum at the same time the Joe Louis Arena opened, and already they're building around that arena, building new projects around that arena. The team president promises that within 2 to 5 years, there will be no empty lots around that forum. In Detroit, we're going to see these empty lots for years, if not decades, perhaps forever.
Does Detroit have any leverage in this? What's Mayor Duggan saying or doing?
Well, he's not saying much. He was on the radio when asked about it a few weeks ago in one of those Ask the Mayor shows. He said, well, my focus is on the neighborhoods. I can't get too bogged down in what's happening downtown. Downtown will take care of itself. I think that's a lame answer. City has very little leverage, even though it did help assemble the land and did help facilitate the clearing of the property so the Illiches could turn it into parking lots. They've got very little, there's very little they can do. The land now belongs to the Illich. Some of it was sold to the Illiches for $1 by the city, a buck per lot. And, you know, the idea was we were going to get something great out of it. What we've got is parking lots.
And we know Chris Illich has been pretty silent and not speaking out about the criticism that's being leveled. And I got to ask, why did it take an outside national media organization, HBO, to point out what's been right in front of us this whole time? How much culpability do you think we in the local media have in all of this?
Well, that's not quite right. I mean, the HBO was following a very detailed Crane story. Kurt Pino and another reporter from Crane's did a very, very good piece, an investigative piece on what was going on in the district, Detroit. And, you know, that's what spurred the HBO report. So local media, you know, at least Crane's, did its job. I think we were all just assuming things were going to happen over there and weren't paying attention. We saw the arena and the business school and, wow, doesn't that look great? And nobody was really paying attention to the fact that the rest of it was being turned into parking lots.
And so looking ahead to the future, as you say, Detroit really doesn't have any leverage.
No, they can't force them to develop the land, nor can they force them to sell the land to others who would develop it. And there's a lot of people who would love to have that land. The Cass Corridor, you look what's happening over there, you know, block after block is being reshaped, redone. And there's a lot of people who would jump to get that land, but the Illiches don't have to sell it, and there's no incentive to. These parking lots are profitable and they're low risk. Why would they give them up?
Detroit News editorial page editor Nolan Finley. Thanks so much, Nolan.
Thanks, Cynthia. Appreciate it.
Michigan's GOP lawmakers are trying another tactic to curb sanctuary policies. Senate Republicans have written a provision into the budget for the state corrections department punishing counties with policies limiting law enforcement from cooperating with federal officials on immigration issues. A state Senate subcommittee passed a version of the Michigan Department of Corrections budget that has this penalty that counties would lose a jail reimbursement. Republican Senator Tom Barrett of Potterville chairs the subcommittee. He declined our interview request, but told our Capitol reporter Shana Roth on Wednesday that while the corrections department calls this a bad idea, he wants to move forward.
I got elected to vote and promote the policy that we make in our state. I work with our partners in the departments, but ultimately we as the lawmakers make the decision as to what goes in their budget.
Well, we turn now to Chris Gouts from the Michigan Department of Corrections. Chris, the senator said it's good to have law enforcement working together, including immigration and customs enforcement and homeland security. What is the corrections department view of this provision?
Well, this is something that we just became aware of when it was put into the subcommittee budget. It wasn't something that we had requested or wrote ourselves. So it was a surprise to us, like it was to everyone else in the room when it was approved. But when we looked at it, the department does not support this language because we believe it's going to impact cases that are very unrelated to the immigration issue itself. And we're not getting into the politics of the issue of immigration. That's not our lane. But we are laying out for those folks who are now looking at this issue and talking about the potential unintended consequences of such language.
When you say cases unrelated to immigration issues, how could this happen?
So the counties are reimbursed for housing individuals who may have been able to been sent to prison, but instead are kept in county jails instead. And the county jail reimbursement program funds counties for housing those individuals. And so rather than them being sent to prison, they go to the counties, and the counties receive, in some cases, a great deal of revenue for that program. And so if this language were to go through and the lawyers who all look at it and in terms of its implementation, they would potentially not be reimbursed for any or for a large number of these prisoners. And so the ultimate outcome could be that the counties, because they wouldn't receive any funding for housing them, that they would lose that incentive and they would instead, the judges would potentially then send them to prison instead.
And what impact could that have on state prison operations and budget and expenses?
Well, if all of those who are in the program currently, if they were all to have been sent to prison, we would need an additional 760 beds. So that means that we would have to reopen a number of currently closed housing units at prisons around the state. Currently, we have about 600 officer vacancies right now. So this would only exacerbate that. It would cause the need to have more positions filled 24/7 in our housing units. which would mean more mandated overtime on our staff.
And what does it mean to someone, the differences between serving time in a state prison versus in county jails?
Well, I think there's a lot. Obviously, when you're in a county jail, one, you're closer to your friends and your family and maintain a little bit of that community connection. If you get sent to prison, you could be sent anywhere in the state, and with roughly 20-some counties that we have prisons around Michigan. But also, it comes with that scarlet letter of a prison sentence. And we know, even though all the strides we've been making with the business community and trying to help through our offender success programs, we do know that stigma still exists for a lot of people, and it can be very difficult to find employment, to be able to find housing once you come out of prison. And so if we can limit the number of people who are sent to prison in the first place and then keep them in county jail where they would serve a sentence of less than a year, for certain individuals, that makes sense for I think for everyone involved. Certainly those who need to go to prison, we have a bed for them, and we're very good at doing that aspect of it. But for a lot of people, they don't need to. Only about 20% of individuals who are sentenced to felonies in Michigan end up in prison. The vast majority either serve time on some sort of probation or go to a county jail or some mix of the two of those.
Chris Gouts, Michigan Department of Corrections. Chris, thanks so much.
No problem. Anytime.
Kent County Sheriff Michelle LaJoy-Young announced earlier this year that county would not detain immigrants for ICE without a warrant after a Marine combat veteran was handed over to federal immigration authorities. Her department stands to lose up to $1.1 million in funding. We requested an interview with the sheriff or a statement on the matter, and the office declined those requests. And we always love to hear from you. What stories or people are you focused on, or issues that you want to hear more about? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook, search for Michigan Radio. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio, or send us an email to stateside@michiganradio.org. Up next, why the University of Michigan's first course on cannabis is drawing students from many disciplines.
And it's not just cannabis, it's about botanical derived medicine, which is an area where doctors just aren't that well versed in.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 10 states, along with Washington, D.C., have now said yes to recreational weed, including, of course, Michigan. And 33 states have legalized medical marijuana. As the weed momentum builds, there is a need for schools to develop courses focused on cannabis. There's a need for scholarship and research. And that is already happening at the University of Michigan, thanks to a professor of pharmaceutical science at the Michigan U of M College of Pharmacy. Gus Rosania is teaching a course, Pharmacy 420. It is U of M's very first course on cannabis. Gus, welcome to the program. So good to have you here.
Thank you, Cindy.
Well, you earned your PhD at Harvard in the 90s, and you've been teaching at U of M since 2001. What prompted your interest in cannabis, and when did that happen?
So I've been working on drug toxicity for 30 years, and these are prescription drugs. And we're faced with an opioid epidemic, and that's currently happening. And it is largely due to the fact that the way drugs are developed ignore or disregard many toxicity properties. So I've been working on this for quite a bit of time, 18 years at the University of Michigan. You know, now we're facing these drug toxicity epidemics, and it's not just opioids. Opioids are just the tip of the iceberg, and there's something that needs to be done, and I'm in a position to do that, and that's why I turned to cannabis.
When you say something needs to be done, so for example, the opioid epidemic that you pointed to, do you see cannabis as an alternative solution to medical issues that could keep us from having people get hooked on opioids?
Yes, it's about the only viable alternative that we have right now that is somewhere in between the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, glucocorticoids, and then the opioids. You know, there's a gap that needs to be filled, and cannabinoids could perfectly be in a position to fill that gap. And what we need to do is research. So there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that perhaps cannabis and especially compounds present in cannabis may be useful to treat pain and inflammation. And we just have to look into that. So this led me into my cannabis interest, and that's why I'm here.
And you have developed this course, PharmSci 420. When did you come up with this idea? We need to do a course, and it is just devoted to cannabis, isn't it?
Yes, yes. So it came about 10 years ago when medicinal cannabis was first legalized in Michigan, but the essentially the conditions weren't ripe then to develop this course for many different reasons.
What were some of the roadblocks?
Well, I mean, it's like we don't know where things were going to go at that time. There was a lot of talk about the social chaos that could come from it. And obviously, a lot of those things haven't happened. Things have just kept pretty much as usual. You know, what's happened is the illegal cannabis use has become legal and controlled. And now the state is in a position to make tax money from it. So So all that seems to be okay. And now, I mean, well, last year with the Proposition 1, that was a major enabling event. Also, the approval of Epidiolex, which is the first cannabis-derived prescription drug that was approved by the FDA in June of 2018, that actually put cannabis-derived medications into the spotlight and also made it part of what people can sell in pharmacies. And all those developments made it the course PharmSci 420 a timely course for this semester. So we just began teaching it.
So tell us what you cover, because you certainly try to go very in-depth with many facets of studying cannabis.
Yes, we go very deep. We actually use a lot of lecturers that we invite from Michigan Medicine, from the School of Public Health, psychiatry, psychology, and then we also tap into the surrounding cannabis dispensary, industrial business community. We also look into the attorneys that are doing cannabis-related work, constitutional experts, so professors from University of Michigan School of Law, people who have worked with the federal government in the process of having to deal with the states legalizing medicinal cannabis. All these people are invited lecturers in the class.
How about law enforcement?
Yes, we've also had, actually, yes, that's very important. So we've also had officials from the Ann Arbor Police Department, as well as prosecuting attorneys and drug recognition experts who are involved in detecting and monitoring DUIs, enforcing DUI laws, come to the class and give their perspective of medicinal cannabis, and then how they're actually dealing with DUIs related to medicinal cannabis.
So who's taking the course, and what kind of response have the students had?
So currently the course is taught at an advanced undergraduate. So these are juniors and seniors. They have to at least have a basic science background. So I require a introductory chemistry course and an introductory biology course focusing on molecular biology. So proteins, DNA, RNA. And I've had students from our own PharmD program who they already have an undergraduate degree. And they're in their PharmD program. So half the class are PharmD students. The other half.
So these are folks who are going to become
pharmacists.
Yes, pharmacists. Yes.
Yes. And then the other half are undergraduates. And the undergraduates come from all over the university. So I've had chemical engineers, computer scientists. I've had business students, kinesiologists, nursing students, biochemists, geneticists,
pre-med,
molecular biologists, neuroscientists, psychologists. And then, I mean, it's like, pretty much it's open to everybody. We have our own Bachelor of Sciences pharmaceutical sciences degree. And obviously, this course has been very popular in that BSPS degree program. So, you know, that is actually really good, because it actually has led to an increase in the number of students interested in the Bachelor of Sciences in Pharmaceutical Sciences, and it is a pre-med degree, so they can eventually go to medical school, they can go to nursing school, they can go to you know, pretty much take any possible future career path within the biomedicine, healthcare sciences.
And how do you hope these students who are in this course, and I know it's the first semester of this course, so they're the first batch to come out, what do you hope they will contribute to the conversation and the understanding of cannabis?
Well, so obviously this is a new generation of students that are going to be going to medical school, nursing schools. I mean, they already have this cannabis background, and that is going to put them in a very competitive position as being, you know, the doctors that we'd want our doctors to be. So I think we're now beginning to train a new generation of doctors that are very well versed. And it's not just cannabis. It's about botanical derived medicine, which is an area where doctors just aren't that well versed in. So now we have doctors that are going to be more willing to bridge between the more natural nutraceuticals and then the more synthetic, powerful, and dangerous prescription drugs. And I think that's going to be absolutely revolutionary in terms of who the doctors are going to be in the future and what kind of how the medicine of the future is going to be practiced.
You know, there is so much that we do not know about marijuana because the laws and policies have made it so difficult to do research, as you've indicated. What kind of roadblocks do you encounter in teaching and researching cannabis? I mean, now that pot is legal in Michigan, are you free to be able to study and do research on the plant?
So that's a complicated question. So there is there's a notion of the plant as a substance. And we can do research on the plant as a substance, and it has to come through official federal channels. And this is a plant that's provided by the National Institutes of Drug Abuse, and the research is funded through the federal government, and as the name of the agency says, it's part of the NIH, and then the research is mostly directed towards showing the abuse potential of the drug or its toxicity potential. My own interest is on the safety side of things. We know that THC and CBD, especially CBD, which is non-psychoactive, unlike THC, CBD is very safe substance as far as we know, based on research that has been done not only in this country, but also in other countries where the research has been in a more favorable legal term. We know it's very safe, and my own interest is to study drug toxicity, but I wouldn't study cannabis because of its toxicity properties. I would actually study it because of its safety properties. People don't die from cannabis-related heart stoppage or breathing stoppage. I mean, like other pain medications, even Tylenol can lead to liver failure. So even Tylenol poses significant toxicity problems, which, as far as we know, the substances present in cannabis do not. So I would like to study cannabis as a safe medication, not as the dangerous medication that the federal government would like us to be studying it for.
Do you foresee a day when cannabis will be reclassified, that we will get past this situation of having it legal according to the state, but illegal and illegal Schedule I substance according to Uncle Sam?
Yeah, so I think the next presidential election may very well be that day. I think it's coming, and it's coming fast. Some people say, I think the most pessimistic people, at least in the cannabis community, they say maybe it's going to take 10 years. I think it's within a 2 or 3 year horizon, and if not the next presidential term, maybe the one after that. So at most, I would say 6 years, but I'm looking more like 2 years.
All right. We shall see. Gus Rosania is a professor of pharmaceutical science at the University of Michigan, where he is now teaching the school's very first course completely devoted to cannabis. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you, Cindy. Thank you for hosting me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Remember Aesop's fable of the tortoise and the hare, where the lightning-fast hare ultimately loses the race to the tortoise, who just kept plodding along? Detroit News business columnist Daniel House thinks we might be seeing an auto version of the tortoise and hare shaping up. Daniel, who's the hare and who's the tortoise?
Well, the hare would be General Motors under Mary Barra, the CEO, probably the hottest CEO in the auto industry today. Very popular, very smart, very respected. Really, I think, leaning forward aggressively, and I mean that in the business sense, in the way she's running the company. Got a really solid team. I think Wall Street thinks that they're executing pretty well. The tortoise is Ford Motor Company, which is being led by Jim Hackett for the last 2 years. At the end of this month, it'll be 2 years in the job for him. And taking a lot of criticism from investors, employees carping about, we don't understand what he's trying to do. We don't understand what he's even saying sometimes. Even though he's speaking in our language, he's not speaking our language. The language of the auto industry, the language of Ford, because he's not a car guy. But I think you've seen this week with their first quarter numbers some recognition that things are starting to fall together. They are doing some interesting partnerships in the autonomous vehicle space and in the electric vehicle space that I think has got some people paying attention. So I think the net-net here is that they're starting to get their gearing, to borrow an automotive phrase, and move forward. Now, you know, these companies can't stand being compared to each other. I've learned that over many years as both a beat reporter and as a columnist.
But you plunged in and did it today.
But I did it. Well, I kind of did it today.
Kind of, sort of.
It was, but I didn't want to be too direct about it because I think oftentimes that can be a little unfair. You know, it can't, because each of these companies have their own challenges. Some of them are similar. Some of them are very different. In the case of Ford and GM, you have very different leadership issues that they've been contending with for the last 3, 4, 5 years. GM's leadership has been a lot more stable under Mary Barra. Ford's has not been as stable, and they're trying to contend with that. But I do think you're starting to see out of Ford an ability to execute. Now, I hasten to add, one quarter does not a turnaround make.
Right.
So we got to see how this progresses. Success really is about continual, consistent execution. And in this case, you've got to be essentially living in two worlds. You've got to be living in the world of trucks and SUVs, both in North America and in other parts of the world, but also mobility, autonomy, and electrification.
And as your column points out, it seems that under Hackett's leadership, Ford's doing that.
I think the evidence is much stronger that they are. You know, under Mark Fields, who he succeeded, Mark was the guy who followed legendary Alan Mulally. Mark, I think, was very uncomfortable with trying to straddle these two worlds. And he would give some rhetorical flourishes towards electrification, but then he would always say, but keeping ourselves firmly planted in the truck business. And it's like, okay, we get it. But I think the board came to the realization that he really didn't have a strategic plan and how they were going to be able to drive both tracks, which I think is required of all car companies today, global ones that expect to be contending, you know, the big six, however you want to count them. Those people all have to be moving on dual tracks or they're going to be left behind.
You're right, and I love your turn of phrase. You say, I wonder if Hackett's wonky side marinated in the Bay Area business culture of innovation and risk-taking isn't a better fit for the times. Why?
Well, you know, historically, this town and this industry has had more or less dictatorial CEOs. We then started to move into an era, I think in the last 10 years, where they tended to be more coach-like. I learned about this from David Cole at the Center for Automotive Research many years ago, that the era of the imperial CEO has kind of died in a lot of cases, not in all companies and certainly not in all cultures, but I think it has changed. Jim Hackett is a guy who is intellectually very attuned to kind of the Silicon Valley, innovative, risk-taking, thinking about things, redesigning the product that we're selling. And I think he's asking some really salient questions. I mean, when you're a car company and you make product mistakes, the United States, Europe, China, and India, there's got to be a problem with your product development processes. And that's the question he's asking. He's saying, look, guys, if we have a problem in one part of the world, maybe we got a problem in that part of the world. But we got the same problem in all the parts of the world. So that tells me that we got problems in our processes. And that's one of the things he's been pushing them to do, is that let's look at the process, how we're designing the product. We can't design a product, one small car, and expect it to sell in India, China, Western Europe, and the United States. Because in India, it's going to be too expensive. In China, it might be too small or too large. In Europe, it might be just right. And in the United States, nobody's going to buy it. So we have to relook at our processes. And he's bringing a lot of that in, that thinking into the company, I think. And people are starting to respond to it.
Well, we will be watching. I know you'll be keeping a close eye on Jim Hackett and his team at the Glass House on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn, CEO of Ford Motor Company. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ever wonder how we do a stateside show? Well, this is your chance to find out. You can join us tonight at the Arab American National Museum in Dearborn at 7 o'clock this evening. We have got a lot of interesting guests lined up, and we're very excited to meet you. And bring a guest. Just go to michiganradio.org to register. The stateside team is looking forward to seeing you tonight, 7 p.m. at the Arab American National Museum in Dearborn. Still to come, how urban and rural communities in Michigan are working to improve maternal health and high infant mortality rates.
Our disparities that we're seeing in infant mortality and maternal mortality are symptoms of a society that does not value all women and children equally.
That is after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. For every 1,000 babies born in Michigan, nearly 7 will not live to their first birthday. And that rate is more than double for African American and Native American babies. As part of its new effort to move the needle on infant mortality, Michigan is tailoring solutions to different communities. Today we meet two women addressing the challenge of infant mortality in very different parts of the state. Leslie Welch is a senior public health lecturer at Wayne State University and a consultant currently leading the development team for Birth Detroit, a women's wellness and birth center. Leslie, welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Bethany Brown is a certified nurse midwife and assistant director of the nursing program at Central Michigan University. She's part of the state's regional infant mortality task force for parts of Central Michigan. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
So, Leslie, I'm going to start with you because I know there are so many programs in the Detroit area that have been working on infant and maternal health, trying to make a dent in the numbers for infant mortality for African American babies, which stands at what in Detroit?
In Detroit, our infant mortality rate is actually 14.2. And so it is, you know, more than twice our number for the state.
So when you think of this racial gap, where are the gaps that need to be filled in?
I think that what is important for everybody to understand is that there is no magic bullet quick fix, that we really have to have the difficult conversations about race and racism and about the political and social economic conditions of women's lives. And so from a public health perspective, we know that that means that addressing the context of people's lives is critically important. And so we have to come at the issue from a political perspective, a community perspective, and a care perspective. All three are very important.
And we think about the city of Detroit and the surrounding areas. They're home to a lot of hospitals and a lot of medical offices, but there are still problems with access to adequate prenatal care. Why is that?
I think there are still challenges around that because there are still challenges in general around families, lives, and transportation, right? And so we know that we need to address the challenges, the larger challenges that families are having, whether it be around income levels and poverty, whether it is housing, whether it's transportation access. Those larger factors complicate how women are able to access the care that exists.
Wayne County has a much higher number of infant deaths, but it's actually Isabella County with the highest infant mortality rate in our state. Bethany, what is driving that high rate of infant mortality in Isabella?
Well, Isabella County is a different world. It's much different than the Detroit area. I originally started my practice in Muskegon Heights, Michigan, as a nurse midwife and women's health nurse practitioner, then came over here to the middle of the state. And some of the situations like transportation and resources are still a huge problem, like they are for Detroit and for Muskegon. But here in Isabella County, we have space, lots of space and limited providers. And that causes problems when you don't have money for transportation, you don't have money for gas, for phone, to get adequate care. In Isabella County in 2017, the infant mortality rate was 11.7, the second highest in our state. We have to look at things like implicit bias for the different populations of people that are here. And that needs to start at the education level, how we train our healthcare providers. And that's going to be a huge undertaking, but it is so very important. And I see this in medicine and nursing starting to change. But yes, definitely an issue. And we actually started at CMU a street medicine clinic where we take care of the homeless. And we've had a large influx of pregnant women, high-risk pregnant women, not only because they're homeless, but for other medical reasons as well, that just go unnoticed, uncared for. So definitely an issue.
When you say implicit bias, what is that? Can you give us an example of what you're talking about?
Yeah, so an implicit bias is when a person has these upbringings and beliefs that they may not be completely aware of, and it shapes how we make decisions and care for people. We can't control how we were raised and the environment we were raised in, but when we start to realize that it affects how we take care of people, then we can start making better decisions for their care. So we're doing a lot of implicit bias training in the state of Michigan. It's hard for physicians and nurses to take time off of work and do this. That's why I say it's going to take time, it's going to take patience, and it's going to take starting at the training level within our university systems.
And Leslie, you touched, you kind of opened the door to this a bit earlier, talking about the problem of racism as a factor in the health disparities that impact African Americans. Can you explain to us a little bit more about how racism plays this role in infant mortality?
Yes. I think one of the best ways I've heard it put, this issue, is that our disparities that we're seeing in infant mortality and maternal mortality are symptoms of a society that does not value all women and children equally. And that really is the core of racism, is that we have, you know, created this false belief in a hierarchy of human value. And it impacts our distribution of resources and opportunity based on race, which has no biological basis. And it creates the larger inequities in the context of our lives. And then when we look at care, we notice differences in how providers listen to or don't listen to, acknowledge or minimize the pain of women, ignore symptomology, disregard decisions and wishes, all around race. And so it is critical that we address both how and why racism is part and parcel of the larger challenges we see, right, around our income levels, housing, poverty, and so forth. But also, even when we take that away and we look at Black women or women of color in general, who may have economic means, who may have education, and may have all of the access in the world, we are still treated differently based on race. And we have seen in one of the most public cases, in the case of Serena Williams, who has all of the resources in the world, that she was challenged to have her providers listen to her care concerns and challenges immediately following her pregnancy. And so we have to acknowledge and move beyond this idea that we could just coordinate and integrate services, to understand that we also have to address respect and rights and freedom and quality and culturally responsive healthcare.
Cindy, this is also a factor in Isabella County. And when we look at maternal mortality along with the infant mortality, what we see here is a lack of primary care. And so a lot of these women have some chronic conditions that just aren't taken care of, and then they get pregnant and they get very sick. So again, opening up the doors to providers and coming up with resources and programs that help support people to come to the rural areas to care for people is very important.
And Bethany Brown, how does that echo what you see in Isabella County, which is home to the reservation of the Saginaw Chippewa Tribal Nation? Native American babies in our state face very high rates of infant mortality. What are the challenges for that population?
Correct. The challenges are the same as we would look at racial disparities in the same way. Their beliefs, their cultures are different than a lot of the providers that are out there providing the care and sometimes are not respected and disregarded. And we're not making an effort to work with the family, work with the woman and her child to come up with the best plan of care that is surrounds their needs and their issues and what's important to them. Not necessarily always what we see as a priority, but what they see as a priority is we have to start at that point. We also deal with, because it's in the middle of Michigan and it's very rural, we deal with lack of being able to get to the people. So we're looking at in Isabella County grants and other things that may help us to provide mobile prenatal care or certified nurse midwives that will integrate. They're trained in dealing with the at-risk population and getting out to their houses and the places where they're at and meeting the patients in their home where they're at and having a better understanding of the issues that are more important to them.
And certainly when we think of the rural community, you can't not think of the impact of the opioid epidemic on rural parts of our state. So does that have an impact when it comes to maternal and infant health in Isabella and surrounding counties?
Absolutely. The opioid epidemic is a huge problem, and not only because the people who are addicted to these drugs have health issues, and then the infants also will have surrounding health issues when they're born, but also because that just compounds the implicit bias problems we have with providers, doctors, nurses, physician assistants, etc., is that they have these beliefs about addiction that may not even be true, or they may not even realize themselves, and that further provides an opportunity for bad service and bad care for these patients who just need some understanding and some help.
If you just joined us, we're talking about addressing the problem of infant mortality in two different parts of the state. From Detroit, we're talking with Leslie Welch, and from central Michigan, in the middle of Michigan, Isabella County, we're talking with Bethany Brown, both of them public health workers who are trying to bring down that infant mortality rate. And I want to kind of dig into what's making a difference when it comes to making things better for moms and their babies. Leslie, what do you see that's working in Detroit?
So I think one of the beautiful things about Detroit is that we do have such a rich community of programs, initiatives, organizations, and providers working around this issue, actually over 100. And we have a strong community also of midwives, of doulas, and community birth advocates. And one of the recent initiatives is Hope Starts Here, an initiative of the Kellogg Foundation and Kresge Foundations. And their vision is that by 2027, Detroit will be a city that puts its children and families first. And they have put together a multidisciplinary collaborative effort around six different strategy areas to improve the lives of families with the focus on the first 8 years of children's lives. And I think that that is critically important. And we also have folks who have been at work in the community for a very long time with programs like Healthy Start, the Women Inspired Neighborhood Network, Black Mothers Breastfeeding Association, and in the last few years, Sister Friends Detroit. I'd also add that we can do more as well to leverage community-based midwifery here in Detroit. And so we have an organization, Metro Detroit Midwives of Color, that's working to improve the diversity of the midwifery community and enhance care that women receive. And I'm also a part of now a local effort called Birth Detroit that is working to develop a community-based women's wellness and birth center here in the city.
So having that birthing center, that right there for women to really focus on, what's it going to take to get that? And what difference do you hope that could make?
It will take a lot of capital fundraising and investment to make it a reality, both in terms of physical space, provider pay, and program development. And our hope and our vision is that we can make the midwifery model of care that we know, you know, works well in hospitals. And also, we know that community-based midwifery care starts to diminish some of the disparities that we see in the maternal infant health outcomes. And we hope to make the model of care available to all birthing persons in the city, regardless of ability to pay.
And Bethany, what's working in Isabella County and mid-Michigan? What are some of the most effective initiatives?
Well, Leslie, I have to tell you, I'm extremely jealous because I went to the University of Michigan and did a lot of work on the east side of the state. And then I moved back home to Muskegon and then now in the middle of Michigan. And we don't have the resources or the people that you do. And we definitely are behind times when it comes to care in a lot of places. When it, you know, I would practice at U of M and then I came over to West Michigan and we were 5-6 years behind what I was doing over there. So it's very frustrating for me at times because getting the interdisciplinary care team together to work on it can be quite difficult around here. We definitely need to strive to integrate nurse midwifery care as a collaborative practice. There's not a lot of it here in the middle of Michigan or in the west upper side of Michigan. And we need to get more people politically involved in the health and well-being of women and children. The state of Michigan is doing that with their maternal infant health equity collaboration. And as being part of that for Region 5, we are looking at bringing different kinds of people to the table and trying to get a good representation of who we serve. So I hope that's a huge first step to understanding exactly all the problems that we need to solve or what we need to pay attention to. And we start to look at different ways in a different care model than the usual to provide services to people who are in these rural areas.
The state has set an ambitious goal of zero preventable infant deaths, zero health disparities. How long, first of all, do you think that will happen? Will the state reach that goal? And how long do you think it would take to do that? What do you think, Leslie?
I think that it can be done. I think that the truth is, as a state, as a nation, we know we can do better. We also know what it takes to do better, right? And so if we commit to intentionally working on improving the context of families' lives, like improving their economic opportunity, improving housing, childcare, pay equity, those things in combination with improving our care systems and enforcing or promoting standards of respectful care at birth and really leveraging community-based models of care and meeting families where they are, we can absolutely do that. There's no reason to think we can't.
Bethany Brown, you get the last word.
Oh, man. Yes, we can do that. And it has to start with respecting women and respecting that women come from a diversity of situations, not just their racial backgrounds, but how they grew up and what they know. And if you don't meet the woman where she is and take into account the things that truly matter to her, you're not going to help solve the problem she has with her family and help protect the health of herself and the well-being of her child. So we can do better at being more involved in starting more initiatives to look at women and the diversity that they bring to the state. And if we do that and we truly respect the humanity of families, I think Michigan can improve that.
Two of the advocates working very, very hard on behalf of moms and their babies in our state, Leslie Welch working in Detroit and Bethany Brown working in mid-Michigan in Isabella County. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Tomorrow, Lester Graham will talk with the woman in charge of the state's big goal of reducing preventable infant and maternal deaths to zero. We'll hear how the state plans to meet that challenge and what it will mean for moms and babies across Michigan. That's tomorrow afternoon on Stateside. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Adam Reyes, Bella Isaacs, and Katie Raymond.
Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.